we're also going to come out with a prequel that will start in Rayford Steele's kitchen and show the events of Rapture from the inside as Irene Steele and her son are raptured up and meet his parents and so on. Then we have the sequel, and that'll be when we decide what we're going to do with the Millennium, probably tie it all together with just one book. Jerry says the problem with that is there won't be any conflict between good and evil, and you have to have that in every fiction book one way or another. And there won't be possible. Can you imagine a time when it won't be possible to sin or break the law? That Christ will be in rigid control, establishing a reign of righteousness.
That's Tim LaHaye, co-author of the Left Behind series, talking about the release last week of the 12th novel in his popular Left Behind series. Glorious Appearing is the name of the latest, and talking about a prequel that he's planning and also the sequel that will deal with the millennial reign of Christ and some of the troubles that, Jerry Jenkins is actually the story man in this writing duo, and Jerry's right. Can you write a novel that has no conflict between good and evil? You could write one. It just wouldn't be very interesting, but it does highlight one of the peculiarities of those dispensational views. Asking for your reaction on the release of the long-awaited 12th in the series, Left Behind series, Glorious Appearing, by Jerry Jenkins and Tim LaHaye. The best of the callers during this 25 minutes of open lines will receive Kim Riddlebarger's book called The Case for Amillennialism, 505-7850, or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. 25 minutes of open lines here, and then Uwe Simonetto joins us for the remaining 25 minutes of the program at 5:30. We'll be talking to him about the lack of Muslim response to the Fallujah killings nationwide, and several other items in our religion roundup with Uwe Simonetto. Now, before the break, I was talking about this new study in Facts and Trends magazine that is basically observing the changes in the last 5 to 10 years. Churches on Sunday morning going to more high-tech approach, going to more contemporary music, more rock pop, if that's what you want to call it. More use of PowerPoint. I sat in a church recently, within the last year, where they used their PowerPoint presentation during the entire service. Now, it was just a regular old screen, and then there was a guy sitting near the front pew. It was all kind of makeshift, but I guess you can call that high-tech if you want to. And he was with one of the PC projectors. He was able to put up his PowerPoint projection of the lyrics of the songs. No surprise there. And then during the sermon, kind of PowerPoint bullet points that appeared almost magically as the pastor hit his various points in his outline of his sermon there on the screen for everyone to see. There was an outline of the sermon also in the printed bulletin, which is that's also on the rise too in the last 10 years in churches on Sunday morning. Now, as someone, maybe this is just me, but as someone who's accustomed to listening to a sermon rather than reading an outline, I'll be honest with you, I found it a little bit distracting. And I also found myself kind of staring at the PowerPoint projection, thinking to myself, well, you know, that's interesting enough, but if we were really using this program to its grandest and fullest potential, we wouldn't just have some outline up there. I mean, show me some graphics. I want to see some things shaking around. I want to see some flashes. I hear some bells and whistles, which some churches are doing, in addition to just having the sermon outline up there. Well, I noted that one of the things that didn't change in the Facts and Trends observation was the length of sermons. If you had a short sermon in your church before, 5 years ago, you probably still have a short sermon. If you had a long one, you probably still have a long one. Although the longest sermons nowadays are only going 40 minutes. Average length among Protestants, 31 minutes. The shortest among the Lutherans and the Methodists. Maybe it is. Sad to admit, cause we just don't have that much to say. You know, having abandoned the heart and center of the Christian faith in many of our pulpits, Christ and Him crucified, what do you got to talk about? So our sermons get shorter and shorter. Christianity Today, several years ago, did a survey that found that pastors were more likely than their listeners to think that their sermons should be shorter. About 75% of pastors said it's important to tailor a sermon's length to congregational expectations, but they sadly misjudged the congregation's expectations. While only half of the listeners, 53%, felt the same way. The builder generation, those who are 55 and older, wanted preachers to cater to their sermon length ideals more than boomers and Gen Xers did. And here's the real surprise of the Christianity Today survey from the beginning of 2001. I quote, "Interestingly, in our survey, Gen Xers seem to have longer sermon attention spans than boomers." Now, we're being told that sermons need to grow shorter, things need to be flashier, more immediate, more eye-catching, more ear-catching on Sunday morning because of the youth. You know, the youth, that TV generation raised with their notoriously short attention spans, practically ADD length attention spans. They can hardly pay attention to themselves in the mirror for more than 5 minutes. It's a wonder that they get dressed in the morning without wandering off into the street someplace because their attention spans are so short, we're told. But apparently Gen Xers have longer sermon attention spans than their parents, the boomers. Perhaps the effect of our fast-paced, media-oriented culture were not as severe as supposed or as commonly preached. Sermons may just get a little longer in the future to satisfy younger generations' desires. A few listeners thought that multimedia presentations or drama would make their pastor's preaching more effective. Only 20% of listeners said that their pastor's sermons would be improved by the use of multimedia. And here you can read things like PowerPoint and music and sound effects and whatever else, dancing hedgehogs, if it keeps people's attention. 63% of pastors, on the other hand, said that having multimedia presentations for their sermons would help. 20% of the listeners said it would help, only 20%, while 63% of the pastors thought it would help. There seems to be a disparity here. Other techniques that pastors were 2 to 3 times more likely than their listeners to believe would help their preaching included storytelling. I had someone comment to me recently via email that he has listened to a lot of Christian sermons lately, and he said, "I hear very little Bible and a lot of stories. A lot of illustration stories, personal anecdotes." Pastors think that storytelling, narrative, and dramatic techniques will help their sermons to the tune of 60%. You know how many of their listeners believe that that would help? 17%. Talk about a gap. Illustrations. 46% of pastors believe it would help their preaching. Only 14% of their listeners thought it would. Movement outside the pulpit. That used to be the sign of a truly daring pastor. If he would step 1 foot outside the pulpit, wow, he was really an innovator. We were told that this would help people connect with the pastor as a person, keep their interest, especially if the pastor put on the wireless and wandered around a little bit. Movement outside the pulpit, 37% of pastors thought it would help. Only 14% of their listeners thought it would help. Personal stories, 25% of pastors thought it would help their preaching. To include personal stories, only 12% of their listeners thought it would. References to pop culture, 22% of pastors thought it would improve their preaching. Only 11% of their listeners. And gestures, 32% of pastors thought it would improve their presentation on Sunday morning if they included more gestures. Only 9% of their people thought so. I've told this story before, but I'll tell it again. I don't know if I've told it on the air. When I was in the seminary, everybody's got to preach 1 or 2 videotaped sermons. This is, generally speaking, one of your very first sermons you've ever written, one of your very first sermons you ever preach. You go into a studio at the seminary with a video camera pointed at you. And if you're lucky, you might have a few of your friends there to listen, to kind of give you a sense that there's an audience. You go in, you preach this thing that you've rehearsed and practiced and memorized. You're in garb. You're doing this, you're told, as though you were preaching to a real live congregation of people. I don't know why they didn't take the video camera to the church and let you do it there, but go figure. So I did my videotaped sermon. It was supposed to be evaluated by a local pastor here, in fact, in the St. Louis area. in terms of its content and, you know, overall, what kind of a sermon was this? This was a preaching course that I was taking. How to preach. Basic sermon writing, content, delivery. You know what my evaluation consisted of? I sure hope it's improved in the latter days here. The evaluation of my first sermon videotaped in the seminary consisted of this. I went into a room with the pastor who was evaluating it. He took out the videotape, popped it into the VCR, turned it on, turned down the sound on the TV, and fast-forwarded through the entire sermon. And we just sat there watching for a few minutes. It was a 15-minute sermon. On super fast-forward, it took about maybe a minute and a half. And during this fast-forward minute and a half of my sermon, no sound, just a fast-forward, as we're watching me move around and gesticulate wildly, he said, look there, you're swaying. You need to stop doing that. That was my evaluation of my first sermon in the seminary. He didn't care what I said. I could have been standing up there saying, Jesus isn't God. He never came in human flesh. He's a myth. The Bible is a lie. I believe in sin. Hell will be a marvelous place. He didn't care what I was saying. Couldn't have given two hoots. I was swaying. He didn't care what I was saying. He only cared that I was swaying. And I walked out thinking to myself, wow. I thought in my kind of smart aleck way in those days, I guess I can preach anything I darn well please in this church, as long as I don't sway. (505) 780-2727. Sam's on the line from St. Louis. Sam, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
What's up, Sam?
Well, I find what you're saying just fascinating. Because I, you know, I'm a seminary student, and you know, just some of the surveys we've been going over are saying that 80% of the U.S. population now learns visually, and that verbal or symbols or words are at the bottom of the list for memory. And so I find it just fascinating that
we're all back in the cradle, Sam. We can't read anymore. We can't understand language anymore. We're just watching the mobile spin around over our head, and that's what we're expected to deliver in sermons. Sam, you still there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. So with your comments and your surveys of congregations, you know, it's saying the opposite of what surveys we have gone over, where we're leaning towards more of a visual sermon. With PowerPoint and using screens, where do you draw the line, and is there a compromise? What is ultimately wrong with using screens or PowerPoint for a sermon?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it, as long as let me answer your question, and thank you for the call. There's nothing wrong with using a screen. Before there was the screen, there was the blackboard. There was the whiteboard. You know, there's always been something that adds a visual element to an oral presentation. All right? So there's nothing wrong in and of itself. There are two dangers. One, when the technology rules the day, just because you can, with PowerPoint or other like programs, have animation, have sound effects, have some eye-catching things, 3D animation, who knows. Just because you can doesn't necessarily mean you should. And the other danger is in believing those surveys. Okay? First of all, just because 80% of people may learn visually, I doubt it. I doubt it. Have you noticed what's going on in your kids' classrooms lately? I remember back in the days when we were told, you couldn't use phonics because kids just can't take the patience to sound out words. They're all going back to phonics. When we were all supposed to learn through videos, children don't take videos very seriously. That's their main means of taking in fiction, not fact. So maybe we should watch some other trends. But the other thing is, maybe, let's say the surveys are right. 80% of the people do learn visually. Does that mean that we stop preaching? You know, the church has a problem with that. Because, and this is something that might get you kicked out of the seminary if you said it in the classroom, Sam, preaching is the divinely appointed means of delivering the gospel. God has commanded preaching. That is a man opening his mouth and speaking. He's commanded that means of delivering the gospel. And, quite frankly, no other. Now, that doesn't mean we can't supplement preaching through other means. Sometimes you got an outline in the bulletin or something like that. There's nothing wrong with this. As long as preaching remains, and I'm far more concerned about the content. You know, there are some things that can be presented in spoken word that cannot be presented. That cannot be presented in a visual medium. And there are things that the visual medium demands, like if it bleeds, it leads in news, that the spoken medium doesn't necessarily demand. I'm coming to you over a spoken medium right now. If everyone's learning visually, how do you account for the unbelievable popularity and lucrative nature of talk radio? If we can't understand the spoken word for more than 5 minutes, how is it that Rush Limbaugh garners 20 million listeners every single week? And he's not the only one doing it. If we can't listen anymore, if we can't assimilate information through the spoken word, I just don't generally tend to believe it. But even if it were true, even if Rush Limbaugh were a resounding failure and no one could listen anymore, which is what we're basically being told, we still have the command to preach. Preach the word, be constant, in season, out of season. Paul says, in the wisdom of God, the world was not given to know God through man's wisdom, but through the foolishness of what we preach. Preach. It is a divinely commanded means of delivering the gospel. Is it foolish? Is it the best way to communicate the gospel? Paul never said it was the best way. He said it's the way God intends us to communicate the gospel. God sometimes draws straight lines with crooked sticks. He sometimes gets things done and accomplishes his purpose through a means that is not the most efficient, not the best qualified. In fact, if you read the Old Testament and the New, God more often than not chooses the least qualified person to carry out his job. He wants Moses to go and be his mouthpiece. Moses, by his own admission, can't talk. He wants a man to trek across the world in pursuit of Gentiles with the gospel, and he gives him a debilitating eye illness so he can't see where he's going. And then he shipwrecks him at every turn and tosses him into prison at every other turn. God has a very peculiar way of getting his preaching out, but it is the preaching he's commanded. Larry's calling from his car. Hi, Larry. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I'm Missouri Synod Lutheran, and I guess one of the things I'd really like to see in this vein, and maybe it's the answer, maybe it isn't, would be for the pastors to raise their expectations of the preparedness of the people who come to church. For example, in other denominations, you see people bringing their Bibles to church. And I know we have Bible studies. I'm a Sunday school teacher. I don't get to go to those because I'm busy during that time. But I think maybe if people had to use their Bibles and maybe even have PowerPoint too, you would get more done to educate them. I think probably part of the problem with Lutheranism is that we come from a lot of farming, you know, background, and people fully expect to, you know, just arrive and have it done to them for 40 minutes, and then they can go back to doing whatever it was they were doing before.
Well, I think that's an affliction that afflicts the urbanite just as well as the farmer, too. Thank you very much, Larry. No, the problem with Lutheranism is not that we come from a farming background. The problem that afflicts Lutherans is the same that afflicts Christians all over the place. We have bought hook, line, and sinker. We have swallowed whatever the culture has fed us. And the culture says, you can't pay attention. I saw a commercial for adult ADD. And the church is doing nothing to reverse that trend whatsoever. And you're right, Larry, in your first comment there. Preachers would do well to not to underestimate their people. They're not a bunch of idiots who can't think or listen. And maybe if we preached up to their expectations and spent less time worrying about every little technique and gizmo we could toss into the service or the sermon to make people more attracted to it, we might get around to straightening out what it is people believe. There's a survey out here that while 55% believe that the Bible, let's see, where is this? 60% of people surveyed believe that the Bible is totally accurate and true in all of its teachings. The same people surveyed in the tunes of 50 to 55% deny things like the real existence of Satan, Christ being the only way of salvation. You know, there's a lot of work to be done among Christians. We spend so much time trying to get their attention. When we finally get it, we have nothing to say to them. Matt's calling from his car. Matt, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, I had 2 points. The first is it's interesting to note that most of the people that are pushing for PowerPoint and other type business type or lecture type presentations and sermons are the same people who want to do away with the traditional icons. And what the Catholics call sacramentals, crosses, icons, stained glass. They would say, "Oh, that's all archaic. We don't need that. We need PowerPoint to put up." So the church has had physical and visual media for centuries. And my second, that's my main point, I guess.
Matt, thank you very much. But, you know, the crucifix doesn't buzz and the stained glass doesn't whistle. They do very clearly communicate, in most cases, the message of the cross. When we come back from this break, we'll be going to a break here in just a few minutes. Uwe Simonetta will be our guest in our religion roundup. We just got a few minutes left here in open lines. Is there anything wrong with using the screen? No. But if the technology, and we need to be honest here and say, when the technology, the toys, the latest computer technology, is actually running the show rather than the message. We should never believe these things are neutral either. That these medium are neutral. The church has the command to preach, to open its mouth and speak. Luther says this, for what it's worth, he says the church, and in his day, it was the urge to use the newest technology, the printing press. Oh, they told him, Luther, if you only printed more stuff, if you only wrote more, what a success this Reformation would be. You know what Luther's response was? The church is not a penhouse, it's a mouth house. We don't have the command to write, although he says, I will write, but first and foremost, I will preach. He says, I will write, I will preach, I will argue, I will do whatever it is, but in the end, this is one of Luther's greatest quotes, he says, in the end, the word does it all. I sit and drink Wittenberg beer with Amsdorf and my other cronies. And while I sit and write and preach and do all these things, the Word does it all. We've lost faith in the Word. We've put our faith in PowerPoint and screens and things that will attract people's attention. And they do attract attention until, of course, they get bored with it. And we have neglected the command that God gives us in Scripture. Preach you the Word. Preach it. Open your mouth and speak of Jesus Christ and Him crucified. We'll be right back with Uwe Simonetto.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Many today equate the worship of God with feeling good about God or about themselves. What is the genuine worship of God through which God heals our anxiety, our depression, and our guilt? Where can we find worship that's focused on God's forgiveness rather than our feelings? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April is called They Will See His Face, Worship and Healing. It's by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Richard Iyer. You can order They Will See His Face by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The book is called They Will See His Face. When you call or write, mention Issues, Etc. 1-800-325-3040.
up to date on evolution. How do we do that?
Answers with Ken Ham, one of North America's most in-demand Christian speakers. Well, Ken, how can Christians defend their faith and keep up to date on all the evolutionary propaganda we see in the media?
Well, that's why we have organizations like Answers in Genesis. You know, our research scientists scour the world for the latest information on what the evolutionary humanists are distributing. We then write articles and books to refute their false claims in order to help Christians oppose these ideas. We let them know they can trust the Bible. And one of the best ways for people to keep up to date and learn how to defend their faith is through our family magazine called Creation. Now, this is a unique glossy color magazine that not only has news articles about the latest evolutionary claims, but features biblical and scientific articles written by the world's leading creationists. We also have videos, books, tapes, and in the near future, we'll have a well-done video series to help people teach the evidence for creation and against evolution. When I was a child, I never had any of these materials, but praise the Lord, there's so much available for Christians today to enable them to defend the Bible right from the very first verse.
Our website, AnswersRadio.com, provides many free materials for your use. Whether it's dinosaurs, the origin of the races, or creation evolution, you'll be equipped when you go to AnswersRadio.com. And find out more about our witnessing outreaches, including at the Greek Olympics this summer. It's all found at AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. On talk shows, politicians are frequently the topic of rude jokes. In movies, political officials are often selfish and corrupt. Such portrayals of politicians can mislead our children to think that everyone in government is corrupt or stupid. It is important that our children are not misled by these messages. The Bible tells us that government is a blessing from God. Politics is an honorable profession, and there are many fine people working in our political system. Teach your children not to be misled by the many negative portrayals of politicians in the media. God loves us so much, He sent Jesus into the world to die for us. He has also blessed us with many good political servants who seek to do His will. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute at www.cmli.org.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org. Welcome back for the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Picking up on something we were talking about during Open Lines before the break and lapping over a little bit here before we're joined by Uwe Simonetto for our religion roundup. Dennis is calling from his car. He had a thought to add as well. Dennis, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Pastor Ted. How are you today?
Very well.
Listen, to add what you had said, I had read a book by Neil Postman. He had written several books about media and culture. And one of the books that he had written was called Technopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about how technology was eroding our culture and that technology was basically taking the place of religion and faith within American society, within Western society, because it was promising all the things that religion was promising.
Yeah, that was the first of his big books there, Dennis. And you're absolutely right in your observation about Postman's. He was insightful. He wrote that decades ago. And realize what was going on there. And by the way, Postman is not a Christian. He's not. He made this observation purely as an observer of culture. His more famous book, both of them are great, but the book that if you must read, you must read, is called Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. You know, I hesitate to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. If Postman's sentiments in Amusing Ourselves to Death were taken to heart by pastors today in the Christian church, we wouldn't have to talk about this. Because they would go back to Scripture and say, it says preach, I'm going to preach. The culture says I should do everything else but preach. Nope, the Bible says I should preach. And you know what? Even though everyone says that this is going to be the most effective means of communication for me to use if I do all this other stuff? Maybe God had a better idea when he says, not only Timothy in the age of preaching, but to us today, preach the word, be constant. That God is known through what we preach, Christ and him crucified. Tomorrow on the show, by the way, we're going to be talking with educational psychologist Dr. Jane Healy. Picking up on this a little bit, a new study on ADD and television viewing tomorrow on Issues, etc. For the next 20 minutes, Uwe C. Minetto is our guest. He joins us regularly for a religion roundup. He's religion editor for United Press International. Uwe, welcome back to Issues, etc.
Good to be back.
I'd like to begin today talking about a recent commentary you have written, A Dearth of Muslim Outrage, obviously in reaction to the events in Fallujah. What have you observed, Uwe?
Well, I've observed that, you know, all right, Muslims in the West, Muslim leaders in the West, reform-minded Muslim leaders, are outraged by the sort of stuff that went on in Fallujah, the desecration of bodies, the murder, etc., etc., etc. What I'm missing here is that, you know, the Muslim leadership around the world gets up and says, wait a minute, this is contrary to our faith, which it is. I mean, the other day, at least one leading cleric, and that is Sheikh Mohammed Tantawi, who is the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar University in Cairo, said precisely that. But just imagine, in the name of Christ, we would go around slaughtering people and then dangling them from bridges and knocking their body, charred bodies with shoes, in the name of Christ, somebody. Or we would strap explosives around the body of a 12-year-old kid or so and say, now, you would commit suicide and blow up 15 other people with it. Or any of these things. I mean, every Christian denomination, to the extent even Pietists and Orthodox Lutherans would get together and say, well, wait a minute, this is not what we believe in. And this, we stop at that. You do not have that sort of reaction. Women, poor little African women, get sentenced to be stoned to death as alleged adulteresses. Do you see any Muslim delegation going to northern Nigeria and saying, wait a minute, this is contrary to our faith? You don't see it. And, you know, at the same time, I keep reading here on the Internet all these whines and we're being so badly treated. I don't want any Muslim or anybody to be badly treated. And I think they should have the right to exercise their religion here. But I would like to see a little bit of more solidarity. They come to us when they feel abused, but I've never seen any reaction from them as a group, individuals, yes, but as a group, against these outrages that are constantly being committed in the name of the Quran.
After the Fallujah events, it was widely observed in the American media that the Washington-based Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE for short, had condemned the Fallujah atrocity, but in very guarded terms. They, strictly speaking, condemned the mutilations of the bodies, but were curiously silent, I don't know, by omission or commission, on the killings themselves. What's your take on that?
Well, that is, they're following the cautious line of virtually all Muslims, with the exception of some very, very few courageous ones who tend to be of European descent. Otherwise, they're following this line. And you know, when I telephoned around leading Muslim interlocutors that I have, you know, well-known scholars. I mean, suddenly I didn't get a call back, you know, even here in this country or in Europe. I didn't get a call back. CARE, the organization you mentioned, I was trying to get some commentary. I've got a brief commentary. I said, okay, provide me with more. Never got a call back. One scholar called me back, but that was way after deadline time, but not from CARE. I don't know what it is, and I think they must be scared out of their wits. I'm not saying that they're being indecent. I'm quite sure they find it as outrageous as I do. But they are scared out of their wits to do so. I don't know whether I told you this a year ago or so, you know, when I tried to, when I asked a Muslim scholar, here actually a jurist, a lawyer, how about these women that are African women are being sentenced to be stoned to death? Oh no, we should all. I would be prepared to lead a delegation, and of course you have to take a new Islamic view and all this. And I quoted her, and the next thing you know is the next morning. Can you correct it, or can you say, well? I said, oh, wait a minute, I had you on tape here, and you knew you were on tape. Yes, 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 but you see, I'm being threatened. I mean, these people are being threatened, they are being menaced, and we still have these blue-eyed fools in Christianity who do not hold their feet to the fire. If we want to have dialogue on these interreligious dialogue, which on some issues, at least on then ultimate issues one ought to have on morals and marriage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then at least we ought to have some sort of solidarity from them. You know.
Two other questions, Uwe, on the Fallujah events. Yeah. First of all, as a journalist, what is your take on whether or not the broadcast media, the television media, should or should not have shown the end result of that atrocity with the bodies hanging off the bridge?
Well, look, I'm an old journalist, and I've been editor of a scandal sheet over in Germany. I would be the last one to get terribly upset about this. No, I do believe it should have been shown. It should have been shown what is being done in the name of somebody's faith, because they went around screaming, saying, we sacrifice our souls and our blood for Islam. Then it should be shown. Maybe we're living in a different generation. When I was a child, I was expected to be bombed and to watch people burn to death in my hometown, and I survived it quite well, and I don't think I'm a mental cripple as a result of it. I think people should face up to the reality of evil that we have, and they shouldn't close their eyes to it.
And then, Uwe, along with the curious silence generally from the from Muslim officialdom nationwide on the Fallujah atrocity, there was also in Iraq, in Fallujah itself, celebration at the.
Oh, yeah, well, exactly.
How do you account for this?
Well, look, I think we are here really dealing with a totally demented group of people. And I don't think that has been done in the name of faith. It's sort of like a sports game. I don't know, like a soccer game. I mean, hey, we've succeeded. We really socked it to them. I suspect, and there's lots of evidence for that too. I suspect that actually what we have here is outside interference, and there were Baathists. I wouldn't even accuse Muslim believers in this, because, for example, the Sunni Muslim Sunni theology is totally opposed to insurrection and calls it evil, and said you should rather suffer than that. But it is nonetheless, it's that.
Do these labels, Sunni, Shiite, in the context of Islam as we face it in the world today and the terrorist threat, can you necessarily say to a Sunni, that's not what you believe, why are you doing that? Or to a Shiite, that's inconsistent with the Quran, why are you doing this?
Well, I think the labels still count, and there is still a basic belief system. The only thing is, we are here in a situation that that I sometimes compare to the situation that prevailed in Germany in World War II, where one-third of the Lutheran pastors or Protestant pastors were part of the confessing movement, one-third were part of the pro-Nazi movement, pro-Nazi German Christian movement, and one-third kept their traps shut. And I think we are, I would say that the Islamic clergy, out of sheer fear, keep their mouths shut, and I don't know how they can justify it in their own faith and vis-a-vis their own Scripture. Certainly we couldn't justify it, but we did, of course. People try to do that in Christianity. It is not doable. But I think that is basically it. Yes, Sunni and Shia accounts. Yes, there are major differences here. As we witness now, for example, the Shia uprising or Shiite uprising in Baghdad, which is very much in line with the history of Shiism. Don't forget the very word assassin derives from a bunch of people who were hashish users, that's what the name meant, and who took hashish in order to prepare for paradise before entering martyrdom. And that's how they see themselves.
Uwe, you have recently begun a series on what you call a schism running horizontally across Christian denominations.
Yes.
Tell us about this.
Well, the schism is really that that we are living, that basically there is a divide that runs across it. On one side, whether it's Catholic or Lutheran or Presbyterian or Anglican, one side is still scripturally based, and the other side is where you make up your own morals, your own ethics, and your own belief system as you go along, and where truth can change and vary from day to day to day. And whilst we may, among faithful Catholics, Lutherans, whatever, have our doctrinal arguments, which are friendly enough, we overlook that within our various faith families, while we are celebrating the same liturgies and while we're singing the same hymns, there are totally different belief system developing. And therefore, what happens is that these groups, whether they're Methodists, you know, think of that lesbian pastor who was acquitted, contrary to her church's book of discipline. She was acquitted of the charge of having committed what she has done. Or the Episcopal bishop who is a homosexual and has his male lover hold the mitre as he's being consecrated. In the Roman Catholic Church, the child abuse, which of course was none other than a homosexual abuse thing, where suddenly, in a Keynesian sort of way, back in the 1960s, people said, well, everything that we taught so far is all nonsense, of course. Basically, as long as we feel good, that's fine. And so, therefore, that is the schism that runs clear across.
Another example of that that you cite in the beginning part of your series,
yeah,
Uwe, is the appointment by the Planned Parenthood Federation of America of a Methodist, another Methodist here,
yeah,
the Reverend Ignacio Castuera, and I was surprised to even find out the Planned Parenthood had a chaplain. Tell us the story.
Yes, and here's a chaplain who said it is theologically justified and good to abort your child. So, you know, so he is a guy who sells his, who wears doubtless a dog collar and goes around saying, what the church has taught in the past is all wrong. I know better, and he gets paid presumably by them, but doesn't lose his by Planned Parenthood. I don't know, but at least he doesn't lose his ordination rights and obligations. It is really quite unbelievable, this, you see, but this is all part of this scheme that we see running across the divide. Then, of course, there's the other divide, the northern and the southern. You have a growth of Lutheranism, a growth of Anglicanism, a growth of Catholicism. Marvelous young priests coming out of Africa and Asia and elsewhere, and then they are being ridiculed by this shrinking denominations like the Episcopal Church here, who say, well, of course, you know, they're so old-fashioned, so backward, and they should really go down and study theology properly the way we have done since Schleiermacher or something like that in the 19th century. And so they're fools. I mean, they're being belittled, and this is not even called racism, you see. It is utter hypocrisy that's going on here.
Some are sensing or think that they hear in the distance the rumblings of totalitarianism, or at least the end of totalitarianism. The Reverend, you quote from the Reverend Raymond D'Souza,
yeah,
a Catholic priest who has written in First Things about this. What does he observe?
Well, D'Souza observes, for example, that in Canada, a medical student who is a devout Christian will not be allowed to graduate because he refused to perform abortions. Well, that's totalitarian. And then, of course, he mentioned the guy Castuera that you mentioned before. You can go on. In British Columbia, Trinity Western University, which is an evangelical institution, denied license to certify teachers because this particular university prohibits homosexual behavior among its students. So therefore, unless you affirm homosexuality, or you affirm sodomy, really, you will not be allowed to be a teacher. The Ontario Human Rights Commission fined a guy who owned a printing business $5,000 for refusing to print letterheads and cards for Canadian gay and lesbian archives. And he said that promoting homosexuality was against his Christian conscience, so therefore he was being fined for having a Christian conscience. This is where we are heading. And, you know, I come across this every day in my practice here as a religion writer, because I can't even, if I wrote about this, I would have 24 hours in a day.
Uwe, you've also characterized this schism running across denominational lines as what you call the third Gnostic crisis, having make, of course, reference to two Gnostic crises faced by the Church previous millennia. Gnosticism as this radical dualism,
yes,
and its view of God being rather particular. Explain that view of God and how you see it playing out in the Church today.
Well, okay. Gnostics believed in a higher supreme divinity, which was who is unknowable, and of course then a lesser divinity called the Demiurge, who is really the creator god and is in charge of, among other things, matter. And my analogy stems from I'm comparing the current Gnosticism with two particular sects within ancient Gnosticism, which said really what. Since the Demiurge is in charge of matter, and matter doesn't really matter because we bypass it and short circuit to the higher divine, to the higher being, matter doesn't matter, and since matter doesn't matter, we can do with our bodies as we please because it is irrelevant and it is immaterial. It doesn't affect our salvation or anything of that. And this is precisely, of course, what we're witnessing right now among people like Bishop Robinson up in New Hampshire, or this this woman in Washington State, the pastor, and assorted others. I mean, you in the ELCA, you now have a pastor in jail for 367 years, and the church is being sued for $300 million. For having allowed this guy, who was known to be a child molester and proved to be a child molester during his vicarage, for allowing him to be certified for ordination, and then some poor congregation in Texas was handed this fiend, and the guy was finally the guy was put away, but not before having done immeasurable harm to eight children or eight young boys. And all this is, of course, because there is a basic concept, which is a very gratuitous concept, of course, since the body doesn't really matter because we already are on a spiritual plane here, we can do as we please.
So, in other words, the same error entertained by ancient Gnostics,
that's right,
is being entertained by modern liberal theologians who are basically claiming a connection with a well, kind of the new spirit of the age disguised as the leading of God's spirit.
That's right.
And so everything that was once wrong is now up for reconsideration.
It's up for reconsideration or you know, irrelevant. It doesn't really matter. As long as we feel good, you know, this. You notice that piety is not the modern term. It is spirituality. We are all spiritual. I mean, these fools in seminaries speak of spirituality, and they don't even realize that, of course, you can be highly spiritual by being a devil worshipper, because the devil is also a spirit. So as long as we're spiritual, as long as we recognize something beyond us here, really our bodies can't matter, and so we can indulge in any lust that that pleases us.
With only 1 minute here, Uwe, yeah. This schism does not go unnoticed by people, especially in the Southern Hemisphere where Orthodox Christianity flourishes. You have quoted from the Archbishop of the Anglican Church of Nigeria to this effect. With only 1 minute, what did he have to say?
Well, he said, you're killing us. You're literally killing us because you, through your media, you're spreading your view around the world. Radical Muslims watch this, see this, and say, oh, hey, look, this Christianity is up for grabs. You can destroy it. We must destroy it. It only takes a little push. So they go around killing Christians because they are fiends anyway. Except, of course, the Christians they kill are not the fiends, because they are faithful blacks and Asians and brown people from South America who have a totally different view and a much healthier view of Christianity than these people have nowadays.
Uwe C. Minetto, thank you for your time and your work, and thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Uwe C. Minetto, religion editor for United Press International. What do you do when you have suddenly taken this broad fisheye lens view of a church, not only nationally but nationwide, that does appear to be split, fractured along several lines? You can conclude one thing. You know what it is? Contrary to the popular belief among us here in America, especially those among us in the church here in America, false teaching, theological error, is not harmless. It's not innocuous. It's not benign. On the contrary, it is malignant. It is harmful. It is noxious to the body of Christ and to the world that body of Christ would seek to save and to help and to serve. We don't do the world or the church any favors by allowing the malignancy, the cancer of false teaching and error to continue among us. Tomorrow, a medical perspective on the suffering and death of Christ with Dr. Gene Rudd of the Christian Medical Institute. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.